Hello, and welcome to RD and the In-Betweens, a fortnightly podcast where we talk to guests about research, development, and everything in between. This week is a special episode with three guest hosts, Ailsa, Marva, and Emily, from the Universities of Bristol and Exeter. You're listening to a podcast on thematic analysis and how to tease meaning from qualitative data. If you're interested about thematic analysis, keep listening for some insights from three researchers from the Universities of Exeter and Bristol who have been through the process. We're also going to hear a little bit from an expert on thematic analysis who shares their key tips on the process. I'm Ailsa and I work in Earth Sciences at the University of Bristol. I'm here with Marva, working in psychology, and Emily, who works in the College of Medicine and Health, and both are at the University of Exeter. Hi there.
Hi.
Great. So lovely to chat today, and let's make some introductions. I myself am a volcanologist, and I started using thematic analysis to study how people remember past volcanic eruptions. How did both of you get into the topic? From what background?
Mm-hmm. So my name is Marva and I'm in the psychology department. So I started using thematic analysis to understand experiences of people who were being ketamine for the treatment, who were being given ketamine for the treatment of alcohol use disorders. How about you, Emily?
Hello, thanks. I'm Emily and I use thematic analysis for my project looking at independence in older people. And this was a mixed methods analysis, so I was using quantitative and qualitative data. So I found thematic analysis with some of its flexibility was really quite helpful for that.
That's really interesting. It sounds like we're coming from very different backgrounds and using thematic analysis in different ways. But for those listeners who are not so familiar with thematic analysis, how would we define that method to them?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. And I think one thing to understand is that thematic analysis is not a single method, but it's used as an umbrella term for a family of methods. And as Emily mentioned, it can be flexible both theoretically, but also in the way that it can be used with inductive, so data-driven, and deductive, so theory-driven approaches, approaches to coding. And it can also capture both semantic, so explicit or latent implicit meanings in data. So what is actually thematic analysis? So it is a pattern-based qualitative method, and it's considered to belong to the phenomenological or experiential qualitative research tradition. So it tries to understand exploration of participants' subjective experiences and making sense of their
work. I think the only thing I can think to add is some people would say it's sort of in the middle in terms of descriptive versus interpretative. Some people would argue it can go any place on the scale depending on how you use it, but I think it generally sort of sits in the middle.
Yeah, Emily, I definitely agree with that. And I think that ties in with what Marva says about it could be an inductive or a deductive approach, that you kind of start with a theory of what you're expecting to see, and you might find that in your research you confirm that. Or conversely, you might start with almost kind of no expectations of what you're going to find in your research, and then you build up your themes as you go along. And I think that that is one of the really good things about thematic analysis, the flexibility that you mention, Emily. And Marva, you use this term, a pattern-based method. I'm kind of interested in that. How could you kind of elaborate on that, pattern-based?
So by pattern-based, I'm referring to qualitative analysis methods that focus on analysing patterns of meaning across data items or cases in a qualitative data set. So what I mean by data items or cases, I'm referring to participants. So thematic analysis is one approach, one pattern-based approach. There are others such as qualitative content analysis, IPA, grounded theory, reflexive thematic analysis, the one I just mentioned, and also pattern-based discourse analysis. I guess pattern-based methods are different than other qualitative methods that examine, for example, the more fine-grained or interactional work of speech, such as conversational analysis, or it's also different from methods that focus on biographies or stories, such as narrative analysis. So that's how we can distinguish thematic analysis from other types of qualitative analyses approaches. Yeah, Emily, did you have anything to add to that?
No, again, I think you've put it really well. I think one of the things about it being pattern-based, so it that also lends to it being quite a useful foundational tool for other qualitative methods. So grounded theory and IPA, I think, both kind of expand on sort of some of the concepts of thematic analysis, although thematic analysis is definitely argued as a standalone method in itself.
I just realized we haven't quite defined what IPA is, and for me, I initially forgot but it's quite a long word, so we should probably specify that. I think it's interpretative phenomenological analysis, you know, just as a note to the listeners.
Yes, good point.
Very nicely pronounced.
I'm always like shying away from saying it because it's such a long one. But yeah, when we say IPA, that's what we're referring to.
Got you.
Not the IPA beer.
That would be a great type of, I'd be very interested in that research. Yeah, Emily, I really liked what you picked up on in that thematic analysis can be kind of standalone, but it also is the foundation for a lot of different other types of analysis. I think that's really key, and that for me in my research was something I instinctively felt. So I haven't done any other types of qualitative analysis than thematic analysis, but it kind of feels when you're doing it that it's so... so powerful and so flexible that you could really use it for other methods. And I wondered, I mean, like I've said, I haven't done anything else apart from thematic analysis, but I wondered if you had both worked on some of these other methods that you mentioned, Marva, and whether you wanted to kind of briefly elaborate on how perhaps whether you like them and whether thematic analysis itself really informed those other methods.
Sure. Well, I have only really used thematic analysis, although I didn't really realise that it was counted as thematic analysis, because going back to the comment you made earlier, it is an umbrella term. So I actually use framework analysis, which, if you go by Braun and Clark's definition, that would be counted as a sort of a code book type of thematic analysis. And so they suggest it's not as rigid as another form, which is coding reliability, which is really keen on having accurate codes that are repeatable and you have different researchers. So that's kind of the key quality of coding reliability. And then you've got the Braun and Clark version of reflexive thematic analysis, which is much more recognising the generation and understanding of the researcher and the impact of the researcher on themes. So code book, which is where mine sits as framework, is sort of in between those two, because it does have a framework which has some sort of deductive codes coming in to start with. And for me, that was useful because that related to the mixed methods sort of side of my project, that I did want to explore sort of the more abstract and deeper kind of meaning that's within my studies, but I also needed to relate it to the quantitative work as well, so then use the deductive side for that.
That's so interesting, Emily, and I think that kind of brings us to a point that I wanted to mention about this, because we defined, we said that thematic analysis is an umbrella term, but we haven't really quite defined what sits under that. And you've referred to these sort of three main approaches within thematic analysis that Braun and Clark mentioned. So, you know, you said the coding reliability approaches, the reflexive approaches, and the code book approaches, with that continuum from coding reliability to reflexive thematic analysis. Yeah, I think that's an important distinction to make. And I think what I would add to that is that Braun and Clark refer to coding reliability thematic analysis as what's called a small Q qualitative research. So when you use qualitative tools and techniques with a post-positivist research value, so sort of the research values that underpin quantitative research and emphasize sort of the objective and replicable knowledge as ideal, whereas the reflexive thematic analysis sits more within the big Q qualitative research, which where qualitative research is not simply conceptualized as tools and techniques. What that means is qualitative both in terms of techniques but also values. So I think that's a really interesting discussion. Yeah.
That is an interesting discussion, Martha. And I wanted to ask you a bit more about that because I still find some of these terms a bit confusing. Mm-hmm. So you kind of said that the small Q qualitative research is you use qualitative tools, but you have values of, I'm guessing, understanding that there's maybe a objective truth out there or things to learn, mm-hmm. whereas the big Q qualitative would be both that you use the qualitative tools but also have a qualitative approach and that you say, well, the truth is subjective. And mm-hmm. this is my interpretation mm-hmm. of what you said, but perhaps you can elaborate because it's good yeah. to yeah hear it in your own words.
I've just got a note here that sort of the big Q is around encompassing the philosophy and procedure. So sort of what you were saying.
Yeah, I guess the point to make here is that there's the what is referred to as small Q qualitative research, which uses maybe the quantitative research values within a qualitative method. And then there's the big Q qualitative research, which where the methods and the values are aligned in qualitative research.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good way of putting it, actually.
And I guess you can see where you sit within this continuum of thematic analysis or qualitative research more generally, depending on what the needs of the research that you're conducting are. Yeah.
And I think the reference for that is Sandelowski and Barroso from 2003, just from what I was reading this morning. So we might be able to put that in the show notes.
And you've also both mentioned Braun and Clark. So I think this is a really key article to kind of, and reference for people to be able to look back on. It seems that I think all of us have found that a really useful resource from our very different backgrounds.
I think one of the really interesting things about Braun and Clark is that they have the original paper in 2006, but they have done lots of papers since and encourage you to read those papers since, because they do reflect on how they've learned and learnt from teaching about it as well. So I think that makes is really helpful but also quite informative for a new researcher to realise actually there is all this reflection and all of this that has gone before.
Yeah, definitely. Like, if you're just starting with qualitative research, don't just go and read their paper from 2006. That was 15 years ago. And they have so many more papers that's come out since then that are really informative. So I think that's one of the most referenced papers in the whole world. I'm not entirely sure. It's about 100,000 times. But, you know, I think they also emphasize that things have moved on from their understanding at that time. So I would definitely recommend reading some of their most recent papers, which we can link in the show notes as well.
That is a mad number of references. But it's crazy, but it's also, I think, confidence building that these people who have written such a seminal resource have also shown that in their subsequent papers they've been pretty reflexive, you know, that because this is a theme or a common feature of thematic analysis itself, this kind of going over and refining, looking back on. So to have some of the most prominent practitioners of it do it in their own work and in their own understanding, that's pretty great, I think.
One other aspect perhaps that we haven't discussed in terms of thematic analysis is is the issue of method versus methodology. And I think before I started doing qualitative research, before I started being involved with qualitative research, I kind of assumed method and methodology were the same thing. So I kind of used them interchangeably, but they actually refer to different things. And I think it would be really useful for people to know. So the way methodology is defined is that methodology refers to theoretically informed frameworks for research. So this include things like IPA, discourse analysis. And on the other hand, method refers to theoretically independent tools and techniques such as semantic analysis. So, you know, from the examples that we've given earlier about pattern-based pattern-based methods and methodologies, thematic analysis and qualitative content analysis are considered pattern-based methods. So these offer people, researchers, tools and techniques that are either atheoretical or theoretically flexible in the case of thematic analysis, for example. And things like IPA, grounded theory, discourse analysis, these are considered methodologies. So these have theoretically informed frameworks for research. That's an important distinction to clarify for people.
Yeah, Marva, I think you nailed it. I mean, I still struggle with method versus methodology, but I think that's quite clear. And for me, it's kind of useful, you know, like what's in an ology, like what's the difference? Mm-hmm. But I mean, one thing that's just occurred to me as you described that, Marva, is that, you know, the method, as I understand it, is theory. So you said it's theoretically independent. So mm-hmm. I could approach that with different research philosophies.
Yes.
And the methodology is informed by a particular research philosophy.
I think in a way, like what Emily said was really helpful in understanding that thematic analysis is theoretically flexible, because, you know, she said how she adapted it to suit the needs of her research project, in the sense that she still needed things to be reliable and replicable in a sense. So she didn't use perhaps the reflexive thematic analysis, which doesn't necessarily concern itself with reliability, and it understands that themes are quite subjective, so it doesn't try to reduce that researcher bias. So, you know, she's adapted the thematic analysis to her research values and philosophy. Yeah.
I keep coming back to that that thing you said at the start, Emily, of how, you know, you liked the flexibility of thematic analysis. And I also, in my research, that was like a really big pull for me, because I had this I just wanted to have quite a powerful tool that could do what I wanted it to do. So Emily, I wanted to ask if there were other appeals of thematic analysis that really led you to choose it to analyze your research.
That's a good question. I think it sort of led me on to think of something else which may not be quite answering the question, but I think is sort of relevant, was referring to Bourne and Clark again, but in, I think it's a 2016 paper, they talk about using this is a tool to be used flexibly, but also with knowingness. So thinking about, although it can be flexible with the theory, thinking about what's underpinning it and how you're using that. And for me, this, it just worked. And I think, so almost the conversation that was having going on in my research is looking at the quantitative and the qualitative and how those speak to each other or not. And the fact that I could use, sort of both deductive and inductive within thematic analysis, and also the fact that it's looking at patterns, so I can almost see, are there patterns between those two types of data, or are there contrasts, just worked well for me, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think what I wanted to also say is something that Emily said is that it can do both. It sort of sits between descriptive and analytical approaches. And again, that's fits within more descriptive, more semantic approaches to thematic analysis versus more latent versus approaches that try to undercover more the latent implicit meanings. So I think that's another benefit of thematic analysis, that you can sort of do both of those things with it.
Yeah, I like that. So I imagine that, you know, if you're undercovering a theme could be something that someone's kind of, one of your, let's say an interviewee says something that you say, well, this text can be taken as read, a descriptive theme, or it's kind of the meaning behind the words is the kind of latent thing that you pick up. And yeah, Emily, from your what you described, it sounds like you like the flexibility, but there was also some kind of structure underpinning it. So you didn't kind of just jump in and say, oh, I'm going to do whatever, but that you use thematic analysis to kind of marry that quantitative and qualitative analysis. And I really like that. I think that's, yeah, a really positive thing of thematic analysis. So one thing I was going to go on to after that was that I think that we all use the software InVivo for thematic analysis. And I wondered if you found that it was easy to kind of marry the analysis of the different qualitative and quantitative data in InVivo.
That's also a good question. It certainly works. Well, I just think InVivo, for me, it works how I think. So if I had a word, my interview transcripts in paper form, I would probably be highlighting and then putting little notes in the margin. And actually, InVivo allows me to do that because I can highlight it and then make annotations. Or if I'm actually thinking about organizing it, I can highlight it and code it. And that works either whether it's a quantitative code or a qualitative code. Yeah, so it just works for me. And then the benefit of InVivo over doing that on paper is that I can then take those bits that I've coded and move them around and look at them together.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great tool, isn't it? Because, you know, before computers or InVivo, I imagine people had to do this by hand. And I think they would print out the interviews and they would highlight, cut and paste, move around, you know, the whole floor being covered by a paper. And, you know, I guess in a way you might become more involved with your data, but it also is very difficult to manage and share with other people, and also very prone to getting lost. So InVivo kind of does all of that in a computer system. And I think it's really helpful in terms of collaborating with people, because we know that you know, in most qualitative research, interviews are coded by more than one person, one researcher. Or, you know, even if it is just coded by you, you still probably want to share it with other people. So it's a great tool for facilitating that. Yeah, so there's a lot of tools around how to work with other people. And this is one of the tools that we've created for the InVivo resources as part of the GW4 network. So if you are in one of those institutions, you will be able to access some information about how to facilitate collaboration on InVivo as well, which we will link to at the end.
Yeah, I love that. My personal experience, I remember the first, my very first getting into thematic analysis and having only 3 interviews to analyse, but the transcripts were each like 20 pages long. And before I got to use InVivo, I was just like, you know, writing down texts and stuff. And I think I had interesting themes, but it was like impossible to organise them or to get a sense of, you know, what was significant or what was just, you know, a kind of small idea, what could be descriptive. And I think in particular that the kind of latent themes for me were much harder to tease out and to understand when I just had big stacks of paper in front of me. And for me, uploading these transcripts into InVivo and being able to organize themes through nodes and kind of link them was like really a game changer. Yeah, was it the same for you, Emily?
Yeah, there's a couple of things you said there that just made me think. I mean, I find it really helpful that you can sort of have everything in one place, so you can use memos to do maybe reflexive memos. Also, you can have a project log as almost maybe your diary because I don't know if you're anything like me, probably have bits of paper everywhere that have little notes that actually I can just have it all on Envivo, which is quite handy. And also I'm a very visual thinker, so some of the visualization tools that Envivo has have been really helpful, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just about to mention that. And I think another really cool tool is if you're using thematic analysis with a more quantitative approach, let's say, you can run coding comparison queries. So if you have multiple people coding on the same project, you can automatically compare how much do they agree in terms of their coding, and you can highlight different, and you can highlight areas where they disagree, so that it can be a really useful tool to enable comparisons of iterator reliability and things like that.
That's really useful to know, because I have only ever coded solo, but going forwards, it could be a really useful thing to be able to again kind of reflect on you know, whether these themes are robust if other researchers involved are kind of seeing those and picking them out, and if not, then there's an interesting dialogue to be had there with other researchers. And I have also used the visualization tools. I don't know if both of you have used, but I'm a particular fan of the word clouds. Talking about, you know, we've talked a lot about all the benefits of the thematic analysis, and I think listeners will be able to tell that we're all fans. But, you know, I know that with everything, there comes some challenges. And for instance, I found initially that it was quite difficult to know how much significance to ascribe to a theme that was emerging in my data. And I wanted to ask you both, you know, any particular challenges that you've come across while doing thematic analysis?
Yeah, I think that's a good point about when you're talking about ascribing, how much weight to ascribe to the different bits of coding, and especially where we've talked about coming from maybe a more quantitative background where you're maybe looking at frequencies and things like that, and actually realizing that in thematic analysis, actually some of the really important and possibly the richest themes can be ones that don't appear all that often, but they're really potent when they do. And they might also encourage you to explore a bit more into the other transcripts as well to see whether it does actually come up. It might have just been a bit more subtle than some of the others.
That's really interesting. I guess for me, one of the challenges was getting my head around sort of this distinction between what's referred to as themes and domain summaries, especially within reflexive thematic analysis. So now I do understand what domain summaries are. So domain summaries are basically a summary of what's been said, or everything that's been said about a particular topic. So for example, if I ask participants a question, I might have asked something like, oh, what are some of the negative experiences you've had with this treatment? And if I just summarize everything that's said, that would be a domain summary, but it doesn't actually undercover the latent meanings behind what they've said. So the themes, now I understand, within reflexive thematic analysis, the themes are sort of uniting the more implicit and latent meanings behind what people have said, not just summarizing what everyone has said. So for example, a list of people have reported these as negative effects of the treatment, sort of thing. So initially that was quite a challenge for me, but again, there are some useful resources around these as well, which we can link to.
We're gonna have so many links in the show notes. It'll be great. Yeah, I think one other challenge I had starting off with is that I had some research questions that I think were led by my my certain approach, feeling that when I was coding my data, I wasn't actually getting answers that matched particularly well to the questions. And so initially that felt quite worrisome. And then I think that what was helpful was understanding that the themes that were emerging could then inform the questions. And in my case, I was able to do more interviews to then kind of revise the questions. So again, it was that thing that, you know, just because the themes didn't necessarily answer exactly the questions that I had posed, that didn't mean that they're wrong. It was a case of recasting things, you know, recreating things and reflecting to understand that things could change. So I'd say moving from a kind of fixed mindset of, you know, my hypothesis is wrong, mm-hmm. which as a natural scientist, that is the approach that we take. And it's like a very ingrained thing, such mm-hmm. that we don't really reflect on research philosophy at all, mm-hmm. to moving something that was like a lot more reflective and a lot more understanding of the subjectivity of meaning and of experience, that I think is really key to thematic analysis, and for me and maybe for you guys too, really attractive to this kind of research.
And I think in a way what you're saying is that your research questions were informed by your data as well, rather yes. than the other way around, which usually is the case with quantitative research. You have a theory which informs your research questions, and then you get the data to support or not support it. Whereas here you got some data and that led you to revise your research questions.
Yeah, exactly. Nail on the head. And that is a really exciting, for me, a really exciting new way to do research.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think one interesting thing about qualitative research generally is that it can generate a lot of hypotheses, right? So I think that's one of the things that I've enjoyed so much about being involved in qualitative research, is that you get such a deep insight into a topic, and it can sort of generate more questions for research that either you answer with qualitative or with quantitative research. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking, Ailsa, your example was sort of just thinking about the deductive and inductive. The deductive is, it can be really useful sometimes to kind of, if you really need to pinpoint a particular aspect and you've got that in your question, but actually the inductive has that place to explore a bit further and may deviate from actually what that initial question was. But as you say, it's just that much more informative, and it's one of the, as Martha was saying, sorry, one of the real joys of qualitative research and how it can be really informative.
Yeah, Emily, you're so right. And it's cool to think, I don't know, cool to think of it as an ongoing process, I think, that it's not kind of done and dusted. It can kind of continually, we can continually learn more and ascribe more meaning. Cool.
Absolutely. I think there's several places where it's been, you know, actually it's, although there might be steps, I think one of the papers we're looking at gives sort of 6 steps to TA, or I think it's the reflexive TA. But actually, although it might be presented as 6 steps, those things are very much, you kind of go cyclical. You might get to step 2 and then have to go back to step 1, and you might just kind of keep reinforcing or learning more, so it develops as you go, which I think is really important as well. And that is part of the adding depth and richness to your data as well.
Definitely, yeah. I think before we wrap up, I just wanted to add something that might be reassuring to people. You know, if you're sort of thinking, is thematic analysis the right choice for me? Or, you know, how do I choose a type of analysis? I think what I found really interesting reading in one of Braun and Clark's paper, they're basically they have a wealth of knowledge in this area, so we refer to them a lot. But I think they say that considering and choosing an analytical approach is sort of more like deciding between which type of fruit you will choose to eat, rather than deciding to whether to have fruit, a slice of cake or a burger. So they kind of emphasize that a lot of different pattern-based methods, for example, can have very similar outputs. So it is an important decision, but it's not choosing between an apple and a burger, but it's more choosing between the types of fruit, which I found quite a reassuring analogy. Yeah.
I like that one.
Yeah, agreed. For someone as indecisive as me, that's very helpful.
Yeah, and I guess, there's a lot of resources around how to choose between different types of pattern-based methodologies and their similarities and differences. So I think one of their papers was comparing thematic analysis to different types of other types of pattern-based methods or methodologies, which can be quite useful for some people to read. So we will link that as well.
Definitely. We'll put that in the show notes. And so I think we'll wrap up there because it's been a really lovely and informative discussion. And we've talked around various aspects of thematic analysis, how we first came to join it, or how we first came to use it in our research, and the benefits and some of its challenges, and also some of the definitions of thematic analysis. And for me, it's been a real pleasure to host this and to share with you guys a really great discussion. So I'd like to thank both of you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's
Thank
been really
you.
interesting talking to you both about this.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Oh, it's lovely. And yeah, we've learned a huge, well, I personally have learned a huge amount, and hope the listeners have too. But as we've said at various points through the podcast, we will include links in the show notes to all of the resources that we've mentioned. So again, a huge thanks to Marva and Emily for our conversation.
Dr. Kat Ashbelby with me right now. She's a lecturer in psychology at the University of Exeter. Kat, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. So I'm a lecturer in psychology at the university, and I did all my training at Exeter as well. And I'm really interested in qualitative methods. A lot of my research has involved qualitative work, and my background is in something called economic psychology, which is how people make decisions about everyday financial life. So things like spending behavior, saving behavior, money and relationships. And then after my PhD, I worked in outside academia in a charity as well, doing research about health and well-being at work. So I've had an opportunity to working in different areas using qualitative research.
Yeah, great. And the way we know each other is obviously you've been really helpful in
Yes.
our qualitative project, and you have a lot more expertise in this topic than I do or any of us do. So we're having this podcast to give a bit of a resource to postgraduate researchers who want to get into qualitative research, specifically thematic analysis. So we have had some definitions of thematic analysis, but I wonder if you could give us like a brief definition in your own words.
Yeah, of course. So thematic analysis is perhaps best understood as like an umbrella term for different approaches to making sense of qualitative data. So there's some really nice resources that you can find online actually through Victoria Clark, like on YouTube, for example, where she talks about the different sort of types of thematic analysis that might be helpful for some of your sort of listeners to go to. But really, it's just the idea that you're making sense of qualitative data through identifying themes is the very sort of base level. But then when you go into it, there's kind of different ways of doing that, whether you're doing it in terms of like what you might have heard of as code book thematic analysis, where you've got kind of a description already, even before you've looked at your data, of what that you might want to find, or what they call as this more reflexive organic approach, where you're much more open to the data and you're going through it on a line by line basis, looking at what the people are saying. So you've got no idea before you start what your findings will be. And that's quite different to the kind of code book approach, where you might already have an idea of what your themes would look like. So there are these kind of differences within it. But yes, it's all about making sense of qualitative data. So whether that be from interviews or focus groups or an online source.
Yeah, that's reassuring that it matches up with what we discussed. So yeah, that's great. Thank you. And I guess our perspective in this podcast has been from three researchers who've mainly trained in quantitative research methods and coming into qualitative research methods later on in our research journeys. So I wondered, in your experience, what are some of the common mistakes people might make when they're using thematic analysis, for example, in our position?
Yeah. So I guess, like, from a positive starting point, that it is accessible thematic analysis for people from different backgrounds. But I suppose there are like common, I guess, mistakes people make in that it's getting used to like working in a completely different way, isn't it? With like a different kind of language of research. So you're moving away from talking about kind of variables and control to talking about, people's lived experiences. So I guess that's something that just people now aren't necessarily always used to, moving away from the research tradition that they've been in to kind of open their eyes to a new way of doing research. In terms of like mistakes, I guess maybe, you know, like we've just talked about that definition of thematic analysis, I guess sometimes there's some lack of understanding that it can actually be this umbrella term, that there are quite different things that you can do. It's kind of one thing. So I guess familiarizing yourself with the different like approaches to TA and doing a bit more reading around it's really helpful. I guess as well, also sometimes people maybe underestimate the amount of work involved. So, and I guess, you know, yourself from having done it, some people think it's just quite very quick that you just, you know, suddenly have these themes, whereas in reality, it's actually quite a lot of work, isn't it? To first of all, get the transcription and then code the data. And then this kind of iterative nature that you're going back between the data and your codes and developing it, and the work that goes into that, people might underestimate.
Definitely. And I think especially with the reflexive thematic analysis, there's a lot of interpretative work that's involved. And perhaps I might have made the same mistake in that thinking it was a lot more descriptive than it really is. Yeah.
So definitely. So I guess that's another one, isn't it? That kind of take. So people get to the stage where they kind of got this descriptive sort of piece about their themes, and then it's taking it that next level of them putting those things together to say, okay, so what are my key findings, what does this mean in relation to my research question. And Brown and Clark talk about the like storybook theme, so that idea that you're really telling a story with your research versus kind of the bucket themes, which is more like just shoving everything in there that you know. So it's kind of that storybook thing where you're trying to say, you know, what's really going on here with my findings.
That's really interesting, and it reminded me of something that we discussed when we were doing the qualitative analysis together, about this difference between the domain summaries and the themes. And I did mention this as one of the difficulties that I initially found with thematic analysis in the podcast, but I wondered maybe if you can sort of give a more elaborate description of what that means.
Yeah, I can try. Yeah, you did a really good job though in your paper, didn't you, in the end. So I think it was more like, you know, so with the ketamine paper, you had like, for example, all the different things that people experienced, and that's kind of, if you're just writing that all down, that's kind of like what some people call like a domain summary. It's like all the different things that happened. But then taking it that next level was then looking at, okay, so maybe these are all really contradictory things, or these are about like transformation. So it's like then those labels of like contradiction or transformation, which then become your themes in themselves rather than the list of experiences. So it's like taking it that next level, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a really good description. So what would you advise? I think you've sort of answered this, but what would you advise quantitative researchers who are new to qualitative methods or to thematic analysis?
Yeah, well, I think doing some like, you know, more study or more reading, like I said, there's some really good online resources. So Victoria Clark has been really influential in like kind of defining and delineating what thematic analysis is. And she's got some really nice YouTube videos that are quite straightforward just to watch to introduce you to some of these things about thematic analysis. And there's also a lot of like papers around that as well that they've done recently, just talking about the different stages of thematic analysis. But I guess as well, it's just about being open to a new way of working and a new kind of language of research where you're more interested in different people's viewpoints, different people's lived experiences. And it's not necessarily about the number of times somebody says something, and trying to get out of that purely quantitative mindset. It's as well as about, you know, the different range of experiences people are having and whether that's something that is interesting and meaningful to your research and could be taken forward to explore more.
Definitely, yeah. I was just going to say it's hard to get out of the quantitative mindset initially, because, you know, when we were first approaching it, we were trying to define how many times or how many participants have said a certain thing. But then you've explained to us, you know, actually, that's not a very useful way of approaching things in qualitative research, because half of the people in this interview said this doesn't mean that half of the people in the general public would say this, or we're not necessarily approaching generalizability in the same way.
Exactly. And the other thing that's really tricky, because obviously if you're using, say, an in-depth interview, it might be that, because obviously with a sort of semi-structured interviews, you don't always follow exactly the same interview questions. So it might be that some people had the opportunity, because they were asked, or it just went down that avenue, to talk about their views on something, so they expressed it, whereas the other people in the other half of interviews might not have had that opportunity. So rather than them not necessarily agreeing or bringing that up as meaningful, it might not have just been part of the questions. Whereas obviously in a questionnaire, everybody's getting exactly the same thing, so you can kind of compare it. So yeah, it's just getting used to that different way of thinking about things. But it is tricky because, you know, it can sometimes, you know, be interesting that every single person thinks something versus nobody. But yeah, it's just getting that balance, isn't it? And thinking about it in a new way.
Yeah, definitely. So if we were to think a little bit about our philosophical position before approaching qualitative research, or more specifically thematic analysis, do you think it's important to define this before starting with analysis? How would you define your philosophical position? It's a really difficult question to ask.
That's a big one. Yeah. So I think in terms of, there's all these different words that people can get quite confused about, like epistemology and ontology and philosophical positions. But I think a lot of it's about thinking about, okay, so what am I trying to find? Am I like inductive? So am I really driven by my data and what people are saying, the participants are saying, and I'm quite open? Or am I more deductive and more theory based? So for example, you know, if I was doing a social, this is a nice paper that looks at social identity approach to food banks and social psychology. And so that would be very much like a theoretical classes where you're very much looking for social identity theory to help explain it, for example. So having this different theoretical position, whether you're very much data driven or theory driven, can influence as well the questions that you ask people in your interview. So in some cases, you know, defining that in advance can be important, but it kind of depends on the stage that you get the data, if you see what I mean. And other people, you know, use different kind of methods. So if you're using like this, we're talking about thematic analysis, but in like, for example, discourse analysis, if you're looking at the way things are constructed in language versus you've got like a more straightforward view of what the language is and what people say, and that's a more like essentialist position. I guess in the past that I've had a more essentialist realist one and a more inductive approach. So it's kind of, you're just open to what the people are saying, and there's kind of a straightforward relationship between what they say and what you're writing. But yeah, I think just being aware that it's more complex than there being one type of thematic analysis, that there are these different positions that people take that can lead to quite different analyses and quite different results, I think is beneficial really when you're doing the work. So, and we talked a bit, didn't we, about small Q and big Q, which I think feeds into these kind of debates as well. So
yeah, I was about to ask that. So yeah, that was something that we discussed from our readings, this idea between the big Q qualitative research versus small Q qualitative research. So I wondered if you can tell us a little bit more about that.
So that I think was Kidder and Fine, and that comes into the idea that you're doing like a project from so if you're doing a big Q one, it's from like a qualitative background, a qualitative like philosophy, and it's what Brown and Clark talk about their organic reflexive one as like a big Q one, because you're just very open to what the participants are saying. You don't think that you have to count the number of times things happen. It's very iterative. You're recognizing that the researcher as an analyst is very involved in interpreting the data, whereas like a small Q one is much more in line with like quantitative thinking, that you'd have to a kind of qualitative content analysis where you were counting the number of times that something happened, and that you had like an idea beforehand of what exactly you were going to count before you even saw the data. You'd know what you were going to count in that, and then you'd count that thing, and that would be a much more small Q example, because you're not really doing the research from a very qualitative philosophy, in the sense that, you know, it's not so much about the participants' lived experiences or being open to interpreting the findings. It's much more like closed off, like a questionnaire would be or something like that. It's like a much more quantitative way to do qualitative research. So that's kind of part of the divide, I think, within. And it's not necessarily all bad to do small Q. That could be exactly what you need in a particular study. But it is recognizing that it's a very different approach from, you know, having much more open questions in your interviews and being much more open to following kind of lines of inquiry from the participant versus this much more kind of closed off way of doing it.
And I guess this kind of shows, in terms of thematic analysis, different approaches to thematic analysis kind of sit along different ends of this continuum from big Q to small Q research. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's what they talk about in some of their papers, this kind of code book one, or the more kind of content analysis, or their reflexive organic one, which is like the big Q. So it does, and there is that kind of middle, that biggish Q in the middle where you are, you know, some maybe predefined ideas in mind, but also you're open to what the participants are saying as well, which is kind of where I think the Ketterman paper sits, isn't it, in the middle.
Yeah, I guess before we wrap up, do you have any other final thoughts or tips that you'd have for PhD or postgraduate researchers approaching qualitative research?
Yeah, I guess just to be open to qualitative research if you haven't done it before, as a it's just, I think most people that even if they haven't done it before and they're in quantitative do find it intrinsically really interesting finding out more about their participants' experiences, because it, you know, compared to the questionnaire studies where you just really can't get much information from people about how they're finding and how they're thinking about things, it does provide this other perspective, which I think is really valuable in so many areas of research.
Yeah, definitely, I agree. I mean, I found that there was such a, it sounds like a bit like a cliche, but it's such a deep insight you're getting into people's experiences, and it was really interesting and informative study. But yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for your advice. And yeah, it was really helpful for me, and I'm sure it'll be helpful for the listeners as well.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode. Don't forget to like, rate and subscribe, and join us next time when we'll be talking to somebody else about researchers, development and everything in between.